My fellow Americans and all those listening overseas, welcome back to Visiting the President. I'm your host, Jay Fakush, and today we are on the road back to the Hermitage, just outside of Nashville, Tennessee, and the gravesite of Andrew Jackson, 7th President of the United States. Before I go too far, I want to remind you to be checking out visitingthepresidents.com, where you can find previous episodes, links to associated readings for the various presidential sites, my photos from the trip, recommended readings, and so much more. You can also follow along on the social media profiles at Visiting the President on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, where I provide additional content throughout the week. Liking and commenting helps to raise the profile, and I appreciate any of you who've written a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. You also find a link to help support Visiting the Presidents through PayPal. Your support helps to fund the production, editing, and hosting of Visiting the Presidents episodes and the website, as well as future trips and books. All support is greatly appreciated, but at the top of the Mount Rushmore giving is Sammy and Tom Fakush, Nancy and Terry Wercamp, Debbie and Dennis Fakush, Harvey and Casey Hyman, Connie and Adam Luck, Brittany and Keith Mellon, Stephanie Gaskell, and Andrew Alexander. Also, Jim and Catherine Hyman, Gail Rittenhouse, Sean and Liz Jones, Stephen Gilroy, Kurt Dion, Alexis Mira, April McKenzie, Matt and Megan Hochstetler, Caitlin Cahalan, Jim and Laurel Brayler, Erica Engartner, Patricia Argentina, Kara Steiner, Jamie and Ted Wilson, Candy and Ben Phelps, Lana Demers and Craig Hunter, Kenneth Robinson, Thomas Kalina, Kristen and Steve Wendell, and Alex Seiker. Thank you all so much. And I also want to recommend that you go back and listen to the previous season's episodes on each president. For season one, we have Andrew Jackson in the Wax House on his two different birthplaces in both North and South Carolina. Great episode. And then season two's Andrew Jackson in the Hermitage for his home as well as vacation spots. So definitely check out those and we'll pick up the action right where we had kind of left off. With Andrew Jackson, he had been successfully reelected in 1832 with a dominant victory over Henry Clay. His second term was dominated by the Cherokee removal and then fallout from the debates over the Bank of the United States, as well as the nullification crisis. Few presidents have dealt with more direct conflict or asked for it, frankly, and assumed more powers as the executive, but it also sapped his energy, which was already starting to flag. And then he has his numerous health concerns, old injuries, as well as the simmering resentment over the death of his wife. Andrew Jackson had come into the presidency informed by decades of a Southerner's distrust of the banks, particularly of the national variety, and that was unchanged by his ascendance into the presidency. His hatred led him to drain the national bank and put the money into state banks, which the Senate retaliated for by formally censuring Jackson, the first president to have this action taken against him. They will later reverse it right before he leaves office. While today Jackson's actions against the Cherokee and other tribes to remove them from lands in Georgia, Illinois, and other states and displace them into Oklahoma is heavily criticized, Jackson believed he was speaking for all Americans in his view that white Americans and then the other minorities were incompatible, that assimilation was implausible and with the country as it was. Jackson took the same view, of course, when it comes to slavery. He felt that the federal government had no role in limiting or expanding slavery, but he also brought his long-formed attitudes about slavery, the racism that he is going to have been raised with, and then just expands over the course of his life, and he'll refuse to entertain what a post-slavery America could look like. With the nullification crisis, Jackson took very personally the idea that Southern states would or could nullify federal laws and even entertain secession. This contributed to a fallout with his vice president, John C. Calhoun, who eventually resigned and headed back to the Senate, where he could be unmuzzled. Jackson replaced him with the more obsequious Martin Van Buren, who had been his Secretary of State. And Van Buren had endeared himself to Jackson when the Petticoat Affair or the Peggy Eaton Affair broke. It sounds crazy when we think of such a personality-driven conflict among an administration to cause such a scandal, but Jackson so offended with Floride, Calhoun, and other secretaries' wives snubbing the second wife of Secretary of War John Eaton, and that accusations she was an adulterer and uncouth probably resonated to him with the way that his wife was treated as well. This eventually led to Jackson turning to what he called his kitchen cabinet, made of advisors he truly valued, which in turn led to the resignation of almost all of the rest of the cabinet. The relationship between Jackson and Vice President Calhoun was permanently severed. It's also hard to overstate how much Andrew Jackson's presidency reframed the office and the political scene. Successors of Jackson viewed their powers through the prism of what Jackson had attempted and accomplished, and how central that he had placed the office in the political life. No president had used the veto power the way Jackson had. In fact, all officers combined had used the veto just 10 times, which Jackson surpasses all by himself. Jackson was also a big fan of the spoil system and empowered the Democratic Party, viewing all partisans as either supporting him or opposing him, which to me sounds a lot like what we'll hear from Franklin Roosevelt down the road. His policies gave birth to a truly oppositional party, with the Whigs divining their early policy solely as a response to his presidency. Jackson's populist bona fides were sealed when he tried to replicate George Washington and James Monroe's attempts at a national tour. In Jackson's case, he was trying to go through New England, a bastion of support for John Quincy Adams, his predecessor, and that's the trip that's capped by Jackson receiving the honorary degree at Harvard that drove John Quincy Adams absolutely crazy in the last episode. The tour will kind of lay bare the age and fragility of Andrew Jackson, who most Americans thought of as the great hero of the War of 1812 and this towering figure. And then when they see him in reality, where he's going to be so much more frail and almost cadaverous, right? That's also going to be a part of it. And his body is pained by the long, slow travel on bumpy and dangerous roads. They initially intended to go all the way through Maine, but Jackson will have the trip turn around in New Hampshire, says he's just unable to go any further. Now, Andrew Jackson is also the first president to be assaulted when a deranged man actually struck him in the face. Jackson was on a steamship in Alexandria, Virginia, and a man came up to him. Jackson said, you know, please permit that I can't rise. I have a pain in my side. And the man bent over and get this, he twists Jackson's nose. It's not the kind of like trick your uncles used to play on you either. The guy actually leaves Jackson's nose very bloody, and Jackson's, of course, infuriated. And in fact, one of the men who's with him is like, hey, if you'll promise to pardon me, I'll kill him, which is crazy, right? He will refuse any increased security measure, saying that somebody wants to assault me, let him come get me, right? He's ready for that fight, even though in reality, like, he had to have been thinking, oh, I don't know if I could do this. In 1835, then, Jackson was attending a funeral at the Capitol building when another deranged man, this time a house painter, stepped out of the shadows to fire two separate revolvers at Andrew Jackson, both of which misfired. Jackson took the opportunity to then beat the man with his cane. Richard Lawrence, the man who was arrested, was interrogated and revealed that he believed, and you'll hear two different stories, he either believes that Jackson had killed his father or that Jackson was the man single-handedly who prevented Lawrence from becoming the King of England, and that he called Andrew Jackson his clerk. He will be, clearly, declared insane and hospitalized until he no longer posed a danger to others. That moment will never come. He'll actually die in a hospital. Jackson, though, will immediately blame the Whigs, saying that they put the deranged man up to that act. Now, John Meacham pointed out that Jackson may have actually been saved by another president's burial plans. If you remember back to episode one, that George Washington had that tomb that was planned for him in the Rotunda. And according to Meacham, I can't find too much else to back this up, but there was a kind of not open pit, but there was an open space that would lead down into the crypt so people could look in on George Washington's burial spot, but that it hadn't been completely filled in yet. And so that led to there being a lot of drafts coming through the Capitol building. But it also meant that it was kind of misty in there and really kind of damp, and that the dampness might have been what eventually makes Lawrence's gunpowder unable to fire. So maybe Jackson owed George Washington for that solid. Andrew Jackson had family with him in the executive mansion, but it did little to blunt the loneliness, grief, and then anger that roiled inside of him. William Seale wrote that Jackson's time in the mansion was split between either working or incapacity, and that Jackson put a big effort into his public appearances, but that belied his actual health. Jackson's predecessors were used to Washington residents dropping by and seeking an audience, having to make themselves available from time to time. But Jackson was a near recluse, with doormen regularly turning away visitors, saying that the president was either ill or he was in cabinet meetings. When he first arrived, a lot of Washington widows descended to try to scope out the general, get a sense of his availability. But he'll make it clear by wearing a small portrait of his wife, Rachel, on a ribbon hanging from his chest. He'll only take it off when he's going to bed. Andrew Jackson's imprint on the executive mansion was seen in the North Portico, finally getting finished. This also made a huge imprint on Jackson himself, who had that portico replicated on his home in Nashville. The East Room was finally finished under Jackson, with the room providing a setting for countless receptions, dinners, and even funerals throughout the years. Jackson installed running water in parts of the house, as well as rebuilding the stables for his beloved horses. The Jackson family spent much of their time on the second floor, with screen doors covering most of their door frames, giving it the feel of a kind of apartment. You're also likely familiar with the famous block of cheese donated by the people of Oswego, New York in 1835 and brought to the executive mansion by a team of horses. This giant block sat in the parlor of the mansion next to a portrait of Jackson for over 2 years, with the public finally invited to come to cut off chunks of it. But the odor is said to have lingered in the home for years thereafter. Now, towards the end of Jackson's presidency, he will be looking forward to a retirement, but wants to first secure his legacy by getting to appoint his successor. In this case, it'll be Vice President Martin Van Buren, who he views as kind of not as great a politician or great statesman, but rather a good steward for Jackson's legacy. Even though, of course, he is a champion of democracy, historian H.W. Brands noted that there is irony that Jackson loved that he could basically appoint the subservient Van Buren to continue his programs. Jackson was all too eager to head back to the newly reconstructed Hermitage Estate in Nashville and was physically exhausted, writing that he had spent most of his last few months bedridden due to a hemorrhage of the lungs, which we'll talk about later. Jackson was the oldest man in leaving the executive mansion. He turned 70 2 weeks after departing, until we get to Dwight Eisenhower over a century later, where both John and John Quincy Adams believed that their days were numbered the minute that they left the executive mansion. Jackson had reason to believe his really were. He became the first president since Washington to leave a farewell address, this time largely written by Supreme Court Chief Justice Roger Taney, largely taking a victory lap, especially on the topic of the Trail of Tears, saying like, well, I did what was right, and now they're kind of out of harm's way, a message I read to my students to say like, this is how they rationalized what they were doing to natives and to the enslaved. Jackson shared with his predecessors not named Adams in believing that attending the inauguration of his successor was important for the continuity of government, despite dealing with a horrible health debacle, like I said. He also had to believe that his popularity could maybe rub off on his much less beloved vice president. Jackson will go to the Capitol and be beside him, both in the Senate chamber when the vice president is getting sworn in, then going out to the East Front for the inauguration itself, and then returning back to the executive mansion with Martin Van Buren, who was also widowed. Van Buren had a reception for the outgoing president. And throughout the inauguration and the festivities, the crowd goes crazy every time they see President Jackson. They couldn't tell that he is physically exhausted, but he will need 3 days before he feels well enough to start traveling back to Nashville. It will take over 2 weeks to arrive, taking over a week just to get to Cincinnati, just to give you a sense of how long that travel took. And Jackson will write to Van Buren that he was surrounded by crowds throughout the ride back by coach and steamboat. Now, Andrew Jackson retires to the Hermitage, like we talked about in season 2, his estate outside of Nashville. Jackson had sunk large funds into expanding the home in 1831, adding one-story wings on both of the sides of the original footprint, which included then space for his office and library, and he even had a portico constructed on the front to give the house its iconic appearance. Jackson was then devastated to find out that a fire breaks out in 1834, not long after he was on his way back to Washington. It was started by, they think, stray embers from a fire, and it will destroy much of the furniture and some of the rooms, especially on the second floor, but Jackson will be committed to rebuilding the home. The office of the presidency at that time only paid around $50,000. That also takes into consideration that all entertaining and household management came out of the president's pocket, leaving, in Jackson's case, no money left over. The panic of 1837 will also impact Jackson the same way that it does much of the country, and his cotton was not as sought after, forcing him to actually borrow money from friends to cover expenses. If this sounds familiar, every one of these presidents, with the exception of the first Adams, really struggles financially afterwards. But in Jackson's case, it's a nationwide panic. There's not a lot of people with money to loan. Like James Madison, Andrew Jackson also had an adopted son who was also being proven to be a wastrel, his nephew Andrew Jackson Jr., whose debts constantly ate into Jackson's finances. While Jackson was in Washington, his nephew mismanaged the Hermitage, and Jackson found himself on the verge of bankruptcy at the same time that his opponents were saying he made money by being president. he'll be forced to take out even larger loans. And there's this episode where, as they're approaching anniversary of the Battle of New Orleans, they want Jackson to come as the guest of honor. And at first he'll beg off. He'll say it's because he's in bad shape. But in truth, it's because he could not afford to go all that way and to be lodged. A group of his friends will put some funds together and he'll borrow against his cotton futures. And so he will show up for that party, but it's not without its huge hurdle. Now, like Washington and Jefferson, Andrew Jackson will be inundated with guests in his retirement, even as his health is failing. Jackson was a consummate entertainer, and he rarely turned anyone away. And when they mentioned the way he entertained, it was oftentimes with pretty simple food, so it wasn't like he was breaking the bank in that way. On good days, Jackson loved nothing more than getting out on his horse and riding around the plantation, visiting the various parts of the farm, and seeing the family that he has in different parts of the estate. He would then spend time in his office or entertaining his visitors, but always before sunset, he would visit Rachel's grave by himself to spend a few moments with her. The end of the day was spent with his correspondence, and then he would gather the family together for prayer. He'd read a chapter from the Bible, as well as then picking out a different hymn before he would kneel in prayer and then be helped into bed. Though he's replaced in the executive mansion, Jackson will stay in close contact with the President Van Buren and even his old foes, waging wars against men like Nicholas Biddle and fighting old battles all the way from the Hermitage. He'll write President Van Buren at least twice a month and even entertained him when he came to the Hermitage in 1838. Jackson tried to defend both himself and Van Buren when the Panic of 1837 set in, with Whigs eagerly blaming Jackson's bank wars as the cause. He'll campaign avidly for Martin Van Buren's re-election, seeing again it as an extension of his own presidency and popularity. He's also just personally offended by William Henry Harrison and the Whig Party's co-opting of Jackson's homespun roots when they use the iconic log cabin campaign and then this suggestion that he's drinking hard cider. These are things that Jackson actually did have, right? He was born in a log cabin. He was that man, that rough and tumble guy from the frontier. And William Henry Harrison's kind of cosplaying. When Van Buren gets defeated, it will bother Jackson as a knock against his own legacy. And he'll try a little to hide his delight when Harrison dies, just 1 month into his term. Spoiler alert, we'll talk about that in a few episodes. But Jackson will see that as vindication for the idea that the office was too much for an inferior man. Jackson will be somewhat pleased by John Tyler's positions on annexing Texas, but he clearly wanted Tyler to vacate the presidency when that situation unfurls. For a time, Jackson was ready to throw his weight behind Van Buren in 1844, with Van Buren even visiting his old boss at the Hermitage again. Everything changes when Van Buren waffles on annexing Texas, and Jackson cut off his support. At first, Jackson had been positioning his protege, James Polk, who had served as the Speaker of the House, was like Jackson, born in North Carolina, made his name as a slaveholder in Tennessee, and had even been nicknamed the Young Hickory. He wanted Polk to be Van Buren's running mate in 1844, but as he starts to have this falling out, he says, no, maybe we should have him be the lead candidate. And so when there is that dark horse candidacy at the Democratic Convention of 1844, Jackson will be delighted when Polk is eventually selected and then will win the office. As with Van Buren, Jackson felt the need to weigh in and give warnings to the new president, including he wants him to make this promise that you'll make all of your cabinet members swear that they will never run for president, which means that he did not have very much optimism in James Buchanan, who was Polk's Secretary of State, but we'll get to that down the road. President-elect Polk actually came to the Hermitage several times before leaving for Washington, and then he'll receive regular letters from Jackson once he arrives. Jackson will also counsel the new president of Texas, his close friend Sam Houston, telling him to not align with any European powers. One last item that is very clear from reading about Jackson's last years is how much he will turn to religion and God. He had always been raised with being a Presbyterian and having these different ideas about God, but he will have a lot of time to devote to his reading, especially when he's in the executive mansion and then in his retirement. And Rachel's death will actually, in some ways, draw him closer. He will be unquestioning that Rachel is waiting for him in heaven. When he retires to the Hermitage, he'll frequently attend the small chapel on the grounds that he had built for Rachel, And then 2 weeks before he died, he's unable to make that trip. And so has the minister come to give him communion one last time. And he actually, it's written by Robert Remini that Jackson never complained about his health from the moment he had that final communion on, that in some ways that gave him that peace. Now we'll turn to the death of Andrew Jackson. Andrew Jackson had suffered for the last couple decades of his life from his war and dueling injuries, and then the pain of losing his best friend and spouse. Now Jackson had been shot in a duel back in 1806 that impacted him way more than he ever let on, permanently damaging his left lung and filling his boot with blood. Now, shockingly, in that moment, he's able to ride the 40 miles back to Nashville with that injury, but he's in bed for more than a month after, recovering from a shattered rib and lungs and a wound that will never fully heal. Doctors resisted going into the cavity, which is shocking, I know, given these nutcase doctors from that moment, but it was believed that leaving the bullet in there was safer than digging around for it, and gotta say, not the worst idea. The bullet, though, will cause an abscess, leading him to periods of these intense fevers, severe coughing, and chills, and then he'll have these periods where he's perfectly fine, but it always recurs, and that will be with him for the rest of his life. The pus from the abscess would lead him to this coughing up of blood, which would temporarily relieve the pressure, but then that horrific cycle would start once again as the abscess created even more pus. It's just awful to read about. Andrew Jackson added to this wound when he was in a fight again in 1813, this time with Thomas Hart Benton. Andrew was apparently trying to horsewhip Thomas, and then Benton's brother will shoot Andrew in the left arm right at the shoulder, shattering his arm. The doctors all say you need to get amputated, especially after Andrew will soak through two different mattresses with blood, but he'll refuse and eventually will, quote, heal, although he'll never fully recover, frequently breaking open that wound until the bullet will finally be removed 19 years later in 1832, using no anesthetic. Benton, who was by then a senator and a friend of Jackson's, was present for the removal and will decline taking the bullet home as a souvenir, which completely feel ya. So Jackson's carrying around these two bullets, has only one functioning lung, and then is given to tuberculosis. He has cataracts, severe toothaches, dropsy that's causing his feet and ankles to swell, and he suffers from chronic diarrhea. When he's running for president, he'll write that he has copious sputum, which is great amounts of slime, as well as these painful headaches that Dr. Rudolph Marx wrote may have been the result of kidney nephritis. Marx added that Jackson's intestinal problems likely caused tooth loss and decay, which Jackson then aids by giving himself calomel, which will actually intensify the tooth loss. Jackson is then self-medicating with, get this, doses of lead and mercury, and then taking sugar of lead, which is acetate, and putting it into his eyes. He said it cooled his eyes. It's insane. If you have cataracts, I'm sure it's painful, right? But pouring lead into, I don't have to tell you. He's also taken to drinking this sugar acetate because he thinks that it's going to help his intestinal crampings, and I'd have to be in a really bad way for that to be the solution. H.W. Brands also noted that Jackson's writing a lot about this potion called matchless sanative when he's writing to his friends, which had a secret recipe that certainly contained alcohol, but also likely contained cocaine or opium or both. And when he'd take it, he'd feel amazing. Which, like, yeah, but he's unaware of what else he's doing to himself. In November of 1836, this is the incident I was alluding to earlier, right as he's starting to write his farewell address, Jackson begins coughing, something he was so used to that he played it down even as he started to cough up blood. It develops into a serious hemorrhage, which required an intense medical regimen where they're bleeding and cupping this poor man. And so over the course of 2 days, and this should remind you of George Washington in episode one, but Jackson said he had been drained of over 70 ounces of blood. He had no idea how he survived, and neither do historians. Like, that's a lot of blood for a guy who's already in really bad shape. We can't emphasize that enough. Jackson said he lived on a diet of milk and mush. That's his words. And he spent the last few months in the executive mansion locked in his bedroom. We don't know that he ever left his room more than four different times. He never went downstairs four times in the last 4 months. That's how bad of shape he was in. So towards the end of his life, now that he's in retirement, Jackson is unable to lie flat in bed on the first floor. He's unable to climb the stairs, so that's out. And he'll greet the many visitors who come to the Hermitage, who are then directed to the bedroom, where he'll be ensconced on a wooden chair with many pillows, is always formally dressed, and they're prepared to meet a kind of aging general, but he's in horrific shape. Jackson has a little table beside him with a miniature Bible, a hymnal, writing materials, and then whenever the mail comes, he just wants to get the Washington letters and newspapers so he can devour those. There will be a servant who sleeps in the same room with Jackson morning, noon, and night to make sure that he's cared for. Jackson will write of himself that I'm a perfect jelly from the toes to the upper part of my abdomen, in any part of which a finger can be pressed half an inch and the imprint will remain for minutes. Jackson was literally, by this point, drowning in his own fluids, owed to an edema where the organs become waterlogged. Combined with his constant stress over the finances, his son has gotten him into the verge of near bankruptcy. He's unable to really find anything lasting, and so he's in really bad straits that way. Unsure of what's going to happen, it reminds me a lot of when we talked about Thomas Jefferson. And then his deep-seated anger at pretty much everyone who's not in his family will make him a very miserable and cantankerous old man. You know, and when I was growing up, I always thought of him that way. But now that I read about his health concerns, I mean, goodness, right? I mean, it would make things really rough. I was reminded, I couldn't find it in any of the books, but I did find the famous quote where they were asking Andrew Jackson if he had any regrets when he was leaving the executive mansion. And he said, "Yes, I regret that I was unable to shoot Henry Clay or hang John C. Calhoun." And he's going to spend the rest of his life disparaging both of them, John Quincy Adams, and again, anybody who comes across him the wrong way. And I always just thought of him as just being this irrational nutcase. But if you couldn't sleep and you were feeling all of these things, yikes, it would be a really bad sitch. On June the 2nd, 1845, a doctor's called in as the edema has left Jackson unable to eat or sleep. He's constantly feeling like he has to go to the bathroom, but is unable. The doctor will then drain fluids from his abdomen, but this doesn't do anything to ease Jackson's misery, and it'll continue through the night. Every night for the next week, Jackson will say goodbye to his family. They're prepared that he will not be awake in the morning, and then he keeps getting up. He'll make clear his wishes for his death. No military funeral, no spectacle, and he wants to be buried beside Rachel in the Rose Garden. They raise the idea of, what if we got you a giant sarcophagus, right? Like George Washington at this point had, like they're building for William Henry Harrison. And he'll say that that's meant for a Roman emperor, and as his, quote, Republican feelings and ethics are going to forbid them doing that for him. I should point out, it was not just any old sarcophagus, if there is such a thing. This was one that had been brought back from Commodore Jesse Elliott, who had purchased it in Beirut when he was serving as a commander of the naval fleet in the Mediterranean, and he brought it back on the USS Constitution along with a mummy and Roman columns. The sarcophagus was 7.5 by 3 feet and had carved rosettes and cherubs, and it was believed that it once had the remains of Roman ruler Alexander Severus. So you can imagine today what we would be talking about with Andrew Jackson, with his controversial legacy being buried inside a sarcophagus that has been brought back as a military trophy from a colonizer. I mean, it's just too much. So crazily enough, Andrew Jackson did not want this. And that does save us from, you know, the huge debate we would be going through right now. He had to sleep propped up and then is put in an armchair for the rest of the day whenever he wakes up. On June the 6th of 1845, Jackson will write a letter to President James Polk about Texas, dictates a letter to another senator. At that point, he's only able to sign his name, and that's the last correspondence that comes out. On June the 8th, Jackson will wake up, he'll be in his chair, and fall unconscious, leading his house servants to start crying out, "Massa's dead." The family gathers around the body as a doctor comes and pronounces him dead, and they prepare to move him to his bed to lay the body out. And those cries will then turn to shock when he opens his eyes. You can imagine how horrifying that would be. He then asks for his grandchildren to come so he can give them a blessing, and he'll talk for around a half hour, which has to be crazy, giving personal benedictions to his family and enslaved servants. He commands each of them to read the New Testament and to keep the Sabbath. When he saw everybody crying, he told them that he was going to meet them all in heaven, quote, black and white, as he emphasized. His last words were, "Do not cry, we will meet again in heaven." Jackson will die at 6 p.m. on June 8, 1845, holding the hands of his daughter-in-law. He is 78 years old. The official cause was kidney failure, but there was a belief among historians that it might have actually been mercury poisoning from the bullets lodged in his body. And that would explain a lot, just in terms of his temperament. But that view has been largely debunked, and it is likely that it was a severe strain on his kidneys, and then the fact he's 78, right? Jackson's friend, Sam Houston, will show up just as he has passed and cries over the body. Jackson does get his wishes honored to not have a large service, and it will be held just 2 days after he died. There's a meeting in Nashville where they're trying to decide how best to commemorate the fallen general and president, and then they get this letter that's like, you gotta show up tomorrow, it's happening, everybody's invited, but we're putting him in the ground tomorrow. Jackson will be laid out in the parlor of the home in a black draped coffin with a shield with his name written over it on a silver marker. His face will remain exposed to the thousands who show up to view the body. Since it is the middle of summer in Nashville, and any of you who've been there know, burying his unembalmed corpse will take a big priority. The service will be held on the front porch of the Hermitage and will mostly be respectful until there is this silence punctuated by Jackson's pet parrot named Paul, which supposedly he had taught obscenities for his own amusement. It had been Rachel's parrot, but for fun, he taught it how to cuss. And so apparently, while the service is going on, the parrot will start to just cuss over and over and over again, and they have to take it all the way out to some of the far cabins before he's calm. In Andrew Jackson in Early Tennessee History, the reverend who presided at Jackson's funeral wrote, "Before the sermon and while the crowd was gathering, a wicked parrot that was a household pet got excited and commenced swearing so loud and long as to disturb the people and had to be carried from the house. He went on to say that the parrot was excited by the multitude and let loose perfect gusts of cuss words. Everyone gathered were horrified and awed at the bird's lack of reverence." And I just kind of want to hear, what did the bird say? Give me an example. I'm that guy. I want to hear it. I want to get petty. No pun intended. Now, this is one of those stories that's a lot of fun to tell, but in terms of it being backed up, it might be apocryphal, but I'm going to tell it anyway. I think it's funny. The minister will read a passage from Psalm 90 and tell me why he picked this one. "Who knoweth the power of thine anger, even according to thy fear, so is thy wrath." Okay, you're going to mention anger, fear, and wrath, and it's Andrew Jackson. Come on. Over 200 carriages and even more horses will fill the area for the mourners. Jackson's body was then taken to the Rose Garden, where he's going to be buried beside his wife. As the service is conducted, they put the first coffin into the second one that's made of lead, and they soldered a lead top on top of it. Jackson apparently had issued one of several demands that he would not have dirt thrown on his coffin. So when the coffin is placed in an open vault of limestone and brick, they then place a slab of limestone over the top with General Andrew Jackson written on top. As with Jackson's predecessor's death, his life will be celebrated nationwide, President Polk closing all public buildings and ordering military personnel to wear black for 6 months. There's a large funeral commemoration held on the east front of the Capitol building, with historian George Bancroft delivering a two-hour-long eulogy and a conclave of carriages stretching down Pennsylvania Avenue. That morning will culminate in a large six-hour public service in New York City, attended by his former Vice President Martin Van Buren, and featuring the procession of a giant urn draped in black and escorted by four white horses and 28 pallbearers headed down Broadway to City Hall to commemorate Jackson's death. As we discussed in the last episode, his predecessor, John Quincy Adams, does not join in the mourning and instead will ridicule Jackson even in death. Jackson divided his estate to pay his debt and then gave the estate and property to his adopted son, Andrew Jackson Jr., with ceremonial swords going to his nephew, grandson, and great-nephew. According to legend, a visitor from Nashville came out to the Hermitage and viewed Andrew Jackson's grave and asked a slave if he believed Andrew Jackson had gone to heaven. The slave responded, supposedly, "If the general wanted to go, who was going to stop him?" Now, in terms of the gravesite, Andrew, like we said, is buried beside Rachel in the Rose Garden with an inscription that he wrote himself, reading, "General Andrew Jackson, born March 15th, 1767, died June 8th, 1845. No mention made of his presidency. His love for Rachel had necessitated a giant cupola that is echoing Homer's Odyssey that's depicted on the wallpaper when you go into the Hermitage in the parlor. Jackson was insistent on having the monument erected while he's away in Washington, and he'll write the epitaph himself. It reads, "Here lies the remains of Mrs. Rachel Jackson, wife of President Jackson, who died December 22, 1828, age 61. Her face was fair, her person pleasing, her temper amiable, and her heart kind. She delighted in relieving the wants of her fellow creatures and cultivated that divine pleasure by the most liberal and unpretending methods. To the poor she was a benefactress, to the rich she was an example, to the wretched a comforter, to the prosperous an ornament. Her piety went hand in hand with her benevolence, and she thanked her Creator for being able to do good. A being so gentle and so virtuous, slander might wound but could not dishonor. Even death, when he tore her from the arms of her husband, could not transplant her to the bosom of her God." And yes, that's all written on that tablet. So whenever you're at the Hermitage, you will see both of those. And hers is just covered in text, while his just has the few lines there. When Jackson visited the Hermitage while president, and then as he retired, as we said, he will visit the grave every evening. He'll make clear before dying, one of his big demands is do not move our bodies, no matter what. But just like we had talked about with Washington and Jefferson, there will be calls around 1860 to move Jackson to the state capitol, with the state Senate even authorizing that move. Now, Andrew Jackson Jr. will put a stop to that, but as the gravesite and the house fall into big disrepair during and after the Civil War, where both the Union and Confederate troops will come by, they view it as neutral ground, so they're not doing a lot of damage to it, but the home is in severe disrepair. And you can listen back to what happens to the home in the aftermath, where there was talk of making it into a veteran's home or hospital. And so the idea of what's going to happen to it will be pretty prominent. In 1894, a man will be arrested for trying to steal Andrew Jackson's body, digging a large hole near where Jackson's casket rested. And this will kind of then get more attention to, okay, what are we doing to preserve this? Now, Theodore Roosevelt will become the first president to visit the Hermitage, and he stops at the gravesite announcing his intention to get federal funds for the upkeep of the house in line with his work on public parks, and he'll follow through on that promise. Franklin Roosevelt will stop out with Eleanor, and he'll actually make an approximation of a walk to that site. As difficult as it is for him, he will be there right at that site. Harry Truman will come through as a judge in the 1930s when he's sizing up Andrew Jackson for the Jackson County Courthouse statue back in Independence, Missouri. Lyndon Johnson comes through the Hermitage on Jackson's 200th birthday, and then Ronald Reagan will come on the 215th in 1982 to lay a wreath, and then Donald Trump will come in 2017. There have been repairs to the fence around the grave and to shore up the foundation, and the Daughters of the American Revolution installed a marker recognizing his defiance of the British as a small boy, which you can hear about in season one's episode. In June of 2018, I found that vandals had broken into the gravesite and they defaced both Andrew and Rachel's markers, spray painting obscenities and an anarchist symbol in red and black spray paint. And this will require careful restoration using these special lasers. They were worried that if they tried to kind of bring it up, they would either damage the stone or make it even worse, right? And so it was then completely repaired, and so now is on public viewing, but there is also 24/7 security to make sure that does not happen again. In terms of you going to visit, the thing to keep in mind is, just like with Mount Vernon, Monticello, or Montpelier, you're going to want to make sure that you're looking at the times that the home is open. There's not an entrance for just the gravesite. You're not able just to kind of mosey up to that site. And so you're only going to be able to go when the entire site is open. So do make sure you're checking through with that. In my experience, it's been open all throughout the year. There's not a season where they take off, but as of right now, I cannot find anything that says they're going to be closed for any period going forward. In my experiences, I have visited now 4 different times. My first was in March of 2013. I'd gone down to Nashville to do research on Cordell Hull for my dissertation about Franklin Roosevelt's time in the Democratic Party, and then as he was becoming president. And so I needed to go to Cordell Hull's papers. I was staying with my friends Jim and Catherine Hyman, who you hear in the beginning, and then would drive down into Nashville every day and work basically not too far from where the State House is. But towards the end of the week, as I was finishing up, I had some spare time, and I was like, I should go out to see Andrew Jackson. Doing all the presidential sites was not on my radar at that moment, but this was probably an inciting incident where I was like, well, I'm in the neighborhood, right? And so So it was a cold, wintry day, and I went out to the site. There weren't too many people, but was able to get in, take a tour, do the museum, and then on my way out of the tour, was able to stop by the gravesite. And so when you see those photos, you'll see the garden, no plants, right? It was still pretty barren. And when I would come back again, it's always been super lush and colorful. This is not the experience on this trip. Did get to see the gravesite and pay my respects, and then was on my way back to my friend's house. My next trip was the very next June, when my parents and I were doing a road trip where we went to St. Louis, Little Rock, New Orleans, and then back up to Nashville. And so I wanted to take them to the Parthenon and other places that I had found on my previous trip to Nashville. And one of those sites was, of course, Andrew Jackson's Hermitage. And so we did a whole tour, did all of the different parts, and then went out to see the gravesite. On this trip, the gravesite was in beautiful shape. The rose gardens were beautiful. I had all sorts of photos of me posed up by the gravesite. And so got a few more photos of the actual markers of both Andrew Jackson and Rachel. It's difficult because of the angle where you're standing. Like, you're not able to look down on the gravesite. So I do have those photos for you on the page. My next trip came in June of 2017. I was doing a giant road trip. This time I was trying to see all of the different sites, but my friend Stephanie and I were coming back from New Orleans, and we're going to go through Nashville on our way back to Ohio. And we were spending the night in Nashville. And so I was like, let's just go out to the Hermitage and check that out. And so again, got to have all of my photos. It was awesome. But did, of course, make as many photos as I can. That's where I got a lot of the photos that you're seeing. And then my last trip was in August of 2022. Remember that initially I'd never taken a photo in front of the gravesites. Like, I just didn't think it was seemly. And so I then had to make another trip where I would actually pose in front of the gravesites. And again, for the website. But on this trip, I was able to do the VIP tour, which was kind of cool to go up on the balcony. And then towards the end of the tour, it went a little longer than I wanted. So I kind of rushed through to go to the gravesite. It was a big tour. And so I wanted to make sure I could get my photos without a bunch of people around. And so did that, and then was on my way. The thing that's really striking about Andrew Jackson's gravesite is that most of the time that we talk about him, he seems like this egomaniac, always centering himself, always centering the stuff that he's really concerned with. And it's one of the few times you see him really taking a back seat, where that cupola isn't for him, it's for his wife, right? And all of the text is his feelings of his wife. And so you really get a sense of just how important she was to him, and how, again, that devastation in losing her is just going to fuel him for the next few years while he's waging war from within the White House and then afterwards. And so that definitely stands out. With Presidents Washington, Jefferson, and Madison, having the gravesite on the site of their home is awesome. You're able to do the kind of two for the price of one and get a better sense of how those presidents lived their life and then how their burial kind of fit into that, right? When we were talking about James Madison's gravesite within that cemetery and how for a while nobody knew exactly precisely where he was resting, there was that idea that, like, well, this is how families do it, right? We take care of our ancestors, we bury them where we can find them. And it's just for us now, 150 years later, that we want that same kind of approach. We want to be able to find the bodies and pay our respects. And so we're in a different mindset than they must have been. That is why I think it's important that we're able to view these sites as they intended it. And again, with Jackson, probably the only thing he cared about was its proximity to the home, so he could go out and see Rachel every day. And then it just so happens, of course, that he's going to be buried beside her. It's very well taken care of. I didn't know anything about this incident. So even on that trip in 2022, I didn't know that in the intervening years, it had been defaced. But you're likely aware of all of the different conjecture around Andrew Jackson himself. When we talk about his legacy, this is where I can tell you that there are 21 counties in the country named for him. There's 12 cities that I could count that were named for him, including the capital of Mississippi, right? Named for him. There's also numerous permutations, including Jacksontown in some states, and then Jacksonville, most notably in Jacksonville, Florida, right? Now, in the years since, I was looking up, I don't think there's been a president who's taken as much of a kind of tumble in terms of our public regard. When Andrew Jackson was first ranked in 1948, he was the sixth best president. And now, in the most recent one in 2024, he was 21. In 2022, he was ranked 23rd. So that gives you a good sense of just how far he has tumbled in terms of how we look at him and the way that we have changed the dialogue on the actions that he took, his views on race are going to completely dominate his decision making, and where the national dialogue on that has shifted, right? In 1948, there were a lot of people who were probably like, yeah, good, right? Like, we love it. We love to see segregation in this country. And now in 2022, 2024, we're seeing where the dialogue could not be more clear that that notion of, you know, that he was doing us a solid by keeping all of the races apart could not be more out of line with where we are as a country today. And I know there's pushback on that. I know, you know, there's always backlash, but the idea that today we just do not see the Trail of Tears the way they did even 50 years ago, 60 years ago. So there is now this reckoning for these statues of Andrew Jackson. I was looking up for the episode. I was trying to find, you know, the different images of Andrew Jackson. And with statues alone, Andrew Jackson, according to the National Monument Audit from this organization called Monument Lab, they count up all of the statues of the different people. Andrew Jackson ranks number 15. Number 15 overall, with 27 public statues. And this brings him in at sixth of the presidents. Of the presidents that we've done so far, George Washington had 171, which is crazy. And then Thomas Jefferson had 36. And we'll talk about the others as we go along. Famously, you can find Andrew Jackson statues. There's the same exact statue done in four different places. The most notable, of course, is right in front of the White House in Lafayette Square. And that one they tried to bring down in 2020 during the protests after the death of George Floyd. There's one in Jackson Square that's the exact replica, and that one has been defaced. They've had paint thrown on it. They have had the head chopped off at one point back when they had the Louisiana State History Museum there in Jackson Square. You could see where they had taken the head off, but it's, of course, since been repaired. That same statue is in Jacksonville, Florida, and there's an effort right now to take that one down, and then another one at the Tennessee State Capitol in Nashville. And I think that's the only one that has not been attempted to be brought down. He's also one of Tennessee's statues in the rotunda of the U.S. Capitol building, and there's a statue of him with the two other North Carolina presidents on the State House grounds in Raleigh. And that's controversial because South Carolina is probably saying, like, he's not yours at all. Now, the statue we talked about a little bit ago with Harry Truman going to size up Andrew Jackson for the statue in Jackson County, Missouri, that's one of the statues that they're talking about taking down. And in fact, the city of Kansas City has said that they are going to take down. There's one of Jackson in Kansas City and then in Independence that they're going to bring both down. Now, it's interesting that with the one at Harry Truman's site, that they did add a plaque that is attempting to kind of better contextualize Andrew Jackson's history. It reads, in part, "The statue of Jackson reminds us that we are on a path that, in the immortal words of Martin Luther King Jr., bends towards justice. In turn, we must acknowledge past injustices to help us create a greater nation built upon humane policies to light our way and the way of humanity everywhere." So again, this reckoning is underway. And I don't think it's lost on me, you know, when you're at the Hermitage, just how much work they do to try to give you a sense of the man as he was, the times that he lived in, but then wrestling with what his policies and what his way of thinking really kind of wreaks on our country. And at that time, right, just how impactful a lot of these things will be when it comes to our country at that critical moment. And so that, again, is kind of all on display. Now, none of that is conveyed in his gravesite, where is actually championing his military service, which is pretty much unimpeachable when we're talking about the War of 1812, his defiance of the British, that all cool. But when you get into the rest of his military service and his attacks on natives, that's when, again, we're starting to see more attention being paid. And, you know, what exactly are we saying when we valorize General Andrew Jackson? So that's a conversation that is still ongoing. Now, one of the things you'll notice when you look at the images on the website, I have a few of the historic images, and it does present this kind of solemn American pastoral image, very reminiscent of what you'll find in that wallpaper in the home that's showing, you know, these beautiful scenes and then just that quiet cupola and underneath it, this wonderful person that needs to be valorized. And of all of the different presidential gravesites, it is one of the more pretty, right? With the giant rose garden around it. And when you know just how much he loved his wife, all that stuff is wonderful. But then when it comes to the rest of the legacy, that's where, again, we're still having this bigger conversation and one that I gotta imagine is going to keep going. Now, you're also likely aware that Jackson is commemorated on the $20 bill, and that is also something that is being scrutinized, where Barack Obama, in one of his last years in office, had announced that they were going to either remove or kind of have both he and Harriet Tubman be on pieces of $20 currency. Now, how many people are using paper currency? I think the dialogue has shifted just, 8 years later. But that then opened up a huge second round of attention. And then that was further exploded when Donald Trump chose a portrait of Andrew Jackson to have in the Oval Office. And so this man's legacy is constantly being debated, right? There was a reason that Trump identified so closely with Andrew Jackson, to the point that he made that trip to the Hermitage to pay tribute to a man that I don't think he knew too much about before becoming president, but clearly is enamored of when it comes to this notion of being a populist. And I did also find some different representations of Andrew Jackson on stage and screen. On stage, you can find a musical called Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson from 2008. And on film, he is in a movie called The President's Lady, where he's portrayed by Charlton Heston. And this is all about the years leading up to Rachel's death. He's also portrayed by Lionel Barrymore in The Gorgeous Hussy, which is talking about the Peggy Eaton affair. Peggy Eaton is played by Joan Crawford. And then in The Buccaneer, where he is portrayed by both Hugh Southern and then Charlton Heston in a remake in 1958. So Heston clearly found something he loved in Andrew Jackson. And gotta imagine, if you're looking for a role, there are a few people who will give you every different emotion, right? Where we see him on deathbed and in his later years, this kind of sad, decrepit figure. And then in the statuary and in the paintings, you see this man who is literally larger than life and strikes a pretty kind of crazy figure towards so many of the other people who were around at that time. I think something that really kind of I connected with on this research was I never really gave too much consideration to how ill Andrew Jackson was, where you read about it and it's like, yeah, of course he got shot and of course he's an older man. But then to read about like how dominating those medical conditions had to have been, like how would you be able to do anything? And in your 60s, you're going to be dealing with all of that and then be expected to live a life and have your wife die on you like that. I get it. I don't excuse it, but I get it. So with that, there's a lot to think about with Andrew Jackson and the way that he lived his life, but also how he's commemorated in death. And so certainly when you get the chance and you're in Nashville and you're at the Hermitage, the beautiful site. And again, we can then wrestle with, what does Andrew Jackson mean to us today? What does he mean to the history? Difficult for me teaching history, hearing people say, what our country has, and we've always done this and we've always done that. And to me, when you see an individual like Andrew Jackson, who does represent where we were at a point in time, and the way that he's held in such esteem by a diverse group of people, right? That both Franklin Roosevelt and Donald Trump were so eager to visit this man's grave, gives you a sense of just how larger than life he was. But again, where we've now shifted and where the dialogue has shifted and where we again have to just be as clear as possible about what this means in our history. So with that, we will turn our attention to a far less controversial man in Martin Van Buren, a guy who I learned a lot more about when I was doing my research for season two. And so I'm eager to look at his very long post-presidency. He'll join when we talked about John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, and then John Quincy, and having these long post-presidencies. Martin Van Buren will be out of office for over 20 years. He's one of the few that gets into that now third decade. But we will talk about Martin Van Buren and his gravesite in Kinderhook, New York. So you won't want to miss that. Remember to check out visitingthepresidents.com, where you can find previous episodes, links to the associated readings for the presidential sites, my photos from various trips, recommended readings, and so much more. You can also follow along on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter just by searching for Visiting the Presidents. Also, please consider supporting Visiting the Presidents by writing a review or donating through PayPal. All season, I've been bringing you content from William D. Gregorio's complete book of U.S. Presidents, Louis Picone's The President is Dead, and I highly recommend Brady Carlson's Dead Presidents. For Andrew Jackson, I recommend, of all else, Robert Remini. He has a series of books, with the most relevant being his Volume 3, Andrew Jackson and the Course of American Democracy, 1833 to 1845, John Meacham's American Lion, Andrew Jackson and the White House, H.W. Brand's Andrew Jackson, and then David Brown's The First Populist, The Defiant Life of Andrew Jackson. All those come highly recommended. And with that, I look forward to seeing you out there on the road as we continue to visit the presidents. See ya.